Now, the thing for you to do is to take this letter to the caretaker at the Shin-in-do. Understand?
No, said Jotaro. He shook his head and raised his right shoulder slightly. Listen, sir.
Well?
You shouldn't judge people by their appearance. I'm not the son of a beggar.
I do have to admit you have a certain knack with words.
Why don't you just take a look at the letter? It may say something completely different from what you think. What would you do then? Would you let me cut off your head?
Hold on a minute,
Kizaemon laughed, and his face with its red mouth behind his spiky beard looked like the inside of a broken chestnut burr.
No, you can't cut my head off.
Well then, look at the letter.
Come in here.
Why?
Jotaro had a sinking feeling he'd gone too far.
I admire your determination not to let your master's message go undelivered. I'll read it.
And why shouldn't you? You're the highest-ranking official in the House of Yagyu, aren't you?
You wield your tongue superbly. Let's hope you can do the same with your sword when you grow up.
He broke the seal of the letter and silently read Musashi's message. As he read, his face became serious. When he was finished, he asked,
Did you bring anything along with this letter?
Oh, I forgot. I was to give you this, too.
Jotaro quickly pulled the peony stem from his kimono. Silently, Kizaemon examined both ends of the stem, looking somewhat puzzled. He could not completely understand the meaning of Musashi's letter. It explained how the inn's maid had brought him a flower, which she said had come from the castle, and that upon examining the stem, he had discovered that the cut had been made by no ordinary person. The message continued, After putting the flower in a vase, I sensed some special spirit about it, and I feel that I simply have to find out who made that cut. The question may seem trivial, but if you would not mind telling me which member of your household did it, I would appreciate your sending a reply by the boy who delivers my letter. That was all. No mention of the writer's being a student, no request for a bout.
What an odd thing to write, thought Kizaemon.
He looked at the peony stem again, examining both ends closely, but without being able to discern whether one end differed from the other.
Murata, he called. Come look at this. Can you see any difference between the cuts at the ends of the stem? Does one cut perhaps seem to be keener?
Murata Yozo looked at the stem this way and that, but had to confess that he saw no difference between the two cuts.
Let's show it to Kimura.
They went to the office at the back of the building and put the problem to their colleague, who was as mystified as they were. Debuchi, who happened to be in the office at the time, said,
This is one of the flowers the old lord himself cut the day before yesterday. Shoda, weren't you with him at the time?
No, I saw him arranging a flower, but I didn't see him cut it.
Well, this is one of the two he cut. He put one in the vase in his room and had Otsu take the other one to Yoshioka Denshichiro with a letter.
Yes, I remember that, said Kizaemon, as he started to read Musashi's letter again.
Suddenly, he looked up with startled eyes.
This is signed Shinmen Musashi, he said. Do you suppose this Musashi is the Miyamoto Musashi who helped the Hozoin priests kill all that riffraff at Hanya Plain? It must be.
Debuchi and Murata passed the letter back and forth, rereading it.
The handwriting has character, said Debuchi. Yes, mumbled Murata. He seems to be an unusual person.
If what the letter says is true, Kizaemon said, and he really could tell that this stem had been cut by an expert, then he must know something we don't. The old master cut it himself, and apparently that's plain to someone whose eyes really see.
Debuchi said,
I'd like to meet him. We could check on this and also get him to tell us what happened at Hanya Plain.
But rather than commit himself on his own, he asked Kimura's opinion. Kimura pointed out that since they weren't receiving any shugyosha,
They couldn't have him as a guest at the practice hall, but there was no reason why they couldn't invite him for a meal and some sake at the Shinindo. The irises were already in bloom there, he noted, and the wild azaleas were about to blossom. They could have a little party and talk about swordsmanship and things like that. Musashi would in all likelihood be glad to come, and the old lord certainly wouldn't object if he heard about it. Kizaimon slapped his knee and said, "That's a splendid suggestion." "It'll be a party for us too," Murata added. "Let's send him an answer right away." As he sat down to write the reply, Kizaimon said, "The boy's outside. Have him come in." A few minutes earlier, Jotaro had been yawning and grumbling. "How can they be so slow?" when a big black dog caught his scent and came over to sniff at him. Thinking he had found a new friend, Jotaro spoke to the dog and pulled him forward by the ears. "Let's wrestle," he suggested, then hugged the dog and threw him over. The dog went along with this, so Jotaro caught him in his hands and threw him two or three more times. Then, holding the dog's jaws together, he said, "Now bark!" This made the dog angry. Breaking away, he caught the skirt of Jotaro's kimono with his teeth and tugged tenaciously. Now it was Jotaro's turn to get mad. "Who do you think I am? You can't do that!" he shouted. He drew his wooden sword and held it menacingly over his head. The dog, taking him seriously, started barking loudly to attract the attention of the guards. With a curse, Jotaro brought his sword down on the dog's head. It sounded as though he had hit a rock. The dog hurled himself against the boy's back, and catching hold of his obi, brought him to the ground. Before he could get to his feet, the dog was at him again, while Jotaro frantically tried to protect his face with his hands. He tried to escape, but the dog was right on his heels, the echoes of his barking reverberating through the mountains. Blood began to ooze between the fingers covering his face, and soon his own anguished howls drowned out those of the dog.
Jotaro's Revenge. On his return to the inn, Jotaro sat down before Musashi and, with a smug look, reported that he had carried out his mission. Several scratches crisscrossed the boy's face, and his nose looked like a ripe strawberry. No doubt he was in some pain, but since he offered no explanation, Musashi asked no questions. "Here's their reply," said Jotaro, handing Musashi the letter from Shoda Kizaimon and adding a few words about his meeting with the samurai, but saying nothing about the dog. As he spoke, his wounds started to bleed again.
"Will that be all?" he asked.
"Yes, that's all. Thanks."
As Musashi opened Kizaimon's letter, Jotaro put his hands to his face and hurriedly left the room. Kocha caught up with him and examined his scratches with worried eyes.
"How did that happen?" she asked.
"A dog jumped on me."
"Whose dog was it?"
"One of the dogs at the castle."
"Oh, was it that big black Kishu hound?
He's vicious.
I'm sure, strong as you are, you wouldn't be able to handle him. Why, he's bitten prowlers to death."
Although they were not on the best of terms, Kocha led him to the stream out back and made him wash his face. Then she went and fetched some ointment, which she applied to his face. For once, Jotaro behaved like a gentleman. When she had finished her ministrations, he bowed and thanked her over and over again.
"Stop bobbing your head up and down. You're a man, after all, and it looks ridiculous."
"But I appreciate what you've done. Even if we do fight a lot, I still like you," she confessed.
"I like you too." "Really?"
The parts of Jotaro's face that showed between the patches of ointment turned crimson, and Kocha's cheeks burst into subdued flame. There was no one around. The sun shone through the pink peach blossoms.
"Your master will probably be going away soon, won't he?" she asked, with a trace of disappointment.
"We'll be here for a while yet," he replied reassuringly.
"I wish you could stay for a year or two," The two went into the shed where the fodder for the horses was kept and lay down on their backs in the hay. Their hands touched, sending a warm tingle through Jotaro. Quite without warning, he pulled Kocha's hand toward him and bit her finger. Ouch! Did that hurt? I'm sorry. It's all right. Do it again. You don't mind? No, no. Go on and bite. Bite harder. He did just that, tugging at her fingers like a puppy. Hay was falling over their heads, and soon they were hugging each other, just for the sake of hugging, when Kocha's father came looking for her. Appalled at what he saw, his face took on the stern expression of a Confucian sage. You idiots! What are you up to? Both of you still only children! He dragged them out by the scruff of the neck and gave Kocha a couple of smart whacks on the behind. The rest of that day, Musashi said very little to anyone. He sat with his arms folded and thought. Once, in the middle of the night, Jotaro woke up and, raising his head a little, stole a look at his master. Musashi was lying in bed with his eyes wide open, staring at the ceiling with intense concentration. The next day, too, Musashi kept to himself. Jotaro was frightened. His master might have heard about his playing with Kocha in the shed. Nothing was said, however. Late in the afternoon, Musashi sent the boy to ask for their bill and was making preparations to depart when the clerk brought it. Asked if he would need dinner, he said no. Kocha, standing idly in a corner, asked, "Won't you be coming back to sleep here tonight?" "No. Thank you, Kocha, for taking such good care of us. I'm sure we've been a lot of trouble for you. Goodbye." "Take good care of yourself," said Kocha. She was holding her hands over her face, hiding her tears. At the gate, the manager of the inn and the other maids lined up to see them off. Their setting off just before sunset seemed very odd. After walking a bit, Musashi looked around for Jotaro. Not seeing him, he turned back toward the inn, where the boy was under the storehouse saying farewell to Kocha. When they saw Musashi approaching, they drew hastily away from each other. "Goodbye," said Kocha. "Bye," called Jotaro as he ran to Musashi's side. Though fearful of Musashi's eyes, the boy could not resist stealing backward glances until the inn was out of sight. Lights began to appear in the valley. Musashi, saying nothing and not once looking back, strode on ahead. Jotaro followed along glumly. After a time, Musashi asked, "Aren't we there yet?" "Where?" "At the main gate of Koyagyu Castle."
"Are we going to the castle?"
"Yes."
"Will we stay there tonight?"
"I have no idea. That depends on how things turn out."
"There it is. That's the gate."
Musashi stopped and stood before the gate, feet together. Above the moss-grown ramparts, the huge trees made a soughing sound. A single light streamed from a square window. Musashi called out, and a guard appeared. Giving him the letter from Shoda Kizaemon, he said, "My name is Musashi, and I've come on Shoda's invitation. Would you please tell him that I'm here?" The guard had been expecting him. "They're waiting for you," he said, motioning for Musashi to follow him. In addition to its other functions, the Shinindo was the place where the young people in the castle studied Confucianism. It also served as the fief's library. The rooms along the passageway to the rear of the building were all lined with bookshelves, and though the fame of the House of Yagyu stemmed from its military prowess, Musashi could see it also placed great emphasis on scholarship. Everything about the castle seemed to be steeped in history. And everything seemed to be well run, to judge from the neatness of the road from the gate to the Shinindo, the courteous demeanor of the guard, and the austere, peaceful lighting visible in the vicinity of the keep. Sometimes, upon entering a house for the first time, a visitor has the feeling he's already familiar with the place and its inhabitants. Musashi had that impression now. as he sat down on the wooden floor of the large room to which the guard brought him. After offering him a hard round cushion of woven straw, which he accepted with thanks, the guard left him alone. On the way, Jotaro had been dropped off at the attendant's waiting room. The guard returned a few minutes later and told Musashi that his host would arrive soon. Musashi slid the round cushion over to a corner and leaned back against a post. From the light of the low lamp shining into the garden, he saw trellises of blossoming wisteria vines, both white and lavender. The sweetish scent of wisteria was in the air. He was startled by the croak of a frog, the first he had heard that year. Water gurgled somewhere in the garden. The stream apparently ran under the building, for after he was settled, he noticed the sound of flowing water beneath him. Indeed, before long, it seemed to him that the sound of water was coming from the walls, the ceiling, even the lamp. He felt cool and relaxed. Yet simmering deep inside him, there was an unsuppressible sense of disquiet. It was his insatiable fighting spirit, coursing through his veins even in this quiet atmosphere. From his cushion by the post, he looked questioningly at his surroundings. "Who is Yagyu?" he thought defiantly. "He's a swordsman, and I'm a swordsman. In this respect, we are equal. But tonight, I will advance a step farther and put Yagyu behind me."
"Sorry to have kept you waiting."
Shoda Kizaimon entered the room with Kimura, Debuchi, and Murata.
"Welcome to Koyagyu,"
Kizaimon said warmly. After the other three men had introduced themselves, servants brought in trays of sake and snacks. The sake was a thick, rather syrupy local brew, served in large, old-style sake bowls with high stems.
"Here in the country," said Kizaimon, "we aren't able to offer you much, but please, feel at home."
The others, too, with great cordiality, invited him to make himself comfortable, not to stand on ceremony. With a little urging, Musashi accepted some sake, though he was not particularly fond of it. It was not so much that he disliked it as that he was still too young to appreciate its subtlety. The sake this evening was palatable enough, but had little immediate effect on him.
"It looks as though you know how to drink,"
said Kimura Sukekuro, offering to refill his cup.
"By the way, I hear the peony you asked about the other day was cut by the lord of this castle himself."
Musashi slapped his knee.
"I thought so," he exclaimed. "It was splendid."
Kimura moved closer.
"What I'd like to know is just how you could tell that the cut in that soft, thin stem had been made by a master swordsman. We, all of us, were deeply impressed by your ability to discern that."
Uncertain as to where the conversation was leading, Musashi said to gain time,
"You were? Really?" "Yes, no mistake about it," said Kizaimon, Debuchi, and Murata almost simultaneously. "We ourselves couldn't see anything special about it," said Kizaimon. "We arrived at the conclusion that it must take a genius to recognize another genius. We think it would be of great help in our future studies if you'd explain it to us."
Musashi, taking another sip of sake, said,
"Oh, it wasn't anything in particular. Just a lucky guess." "Come now, don't be modest."
"I'm not being modest. It was a feeling I got, from the look of the cut."
"Just what sort of feeling was it?"
As they would with any stranger, these four senior disciples of the House of Yagyu were trying to analyze Musashi as a human being and at the same time test him. They had already taken note of his physique, admiring his carriage and the expression in his eyes. But the way he held his sake cup and his chopsticks betrayed his country upbringing and made them inclined to be patronizing. After only three or four cups of sake,
Musashi's face turned copper red. Embarrassed, he touched his hand to his forehead and cheeks 2 or 3 times. The boyishness of the gesture made them laugh.
"This feeling of yours," repeated Kizaimon.
"Can't you tell us more about it?
You know, this building, the Shin-in-do, was built expressly for Lord Koizumi of Ise to stay in during his visits. It's an important building in the history of swordsmanship. It's a fitting place for us to hear a lecture from you tonight."
Realizing that protesting their flattery was not going to get him off the hook, Musashi decided to take the plunge.
"When you sense something, you sense it," he said. "There's really no way to explain it. If you want me to demonstrate what I mean, you'll have to unsheath your sword and face me in a match. There's no other way."
The smoke from the lamp rose as black as squid ink in the still night air. The croaking frog was heard again. Kizaimon and Debuchi, the two eldest, looked at each other and laughed. Though he had spoken quietly, the statement about testing him had undeniably been a challenge, and they recognized it as such. Letting it pass without comment, they talked about swords, then about Zen, events in other provinces, the Battle of Sekigahara. Kizaimon, Debuchi, and Kimura had all taken part in the bloody conflict, and to Musashi, who had been on the opposing side, their stories had the ring of bitter truth. The hosts appeared to be enjoying the conversation immensely, and Musashi found it fascinating just to listen. He was nonetheless conscious of the swift passage of time, knowing in his heart that if he did not meet Sekishusai tonight, he would never meet him. Kizaimon announced it was time for the barley mixed with rice, the customary last course, to be served, and the sake was removed.
"How can I see him?" thought Musashi.
It became increasingly clear that he might be forced to employ some underhanded scheme. Should he goad one of his hosts into losing his temper? Difficult when he was not angry himself, so he purposefully disagreed several times with what was being said and spoke in a rude and brash manner. Shoda and Debuchi chose to laugh at this. None of these four was about to be provoked into doing anything rash. Desperation set in. Musashi could not bear the idea of leaving without accomplishing his objective. For his crown, he wanted a brilliant star of victory, and for the record, he wanted it known that Musashi had been here, had gone, had left his mark on the house of Yagyu. With his own sword, he wanted to bring Sekishusai, this great patriarch of the martial arts, this ancient dragon, as he was called, to his knees. Had they seen through him completely? He was considering this possibility when matters took an unexpected turn.
"Did you hear that?"
asked Kimura. Murata went out on the veranda, then, re-entering the room, said,
"Taro's barking. Not his usual bark, though. I think something must be wrong."
Taro was the dog Jotaro had had a run-in with. There was no denying that the barking, which seemed to come from the second encirclement of the castle, was frightening. It sounded too loud and terrible to be coming from a single dog. Debuchi said,
"I think I'd better have a look. Forgive me, Musashi, for spoiling the party, but it may be important. Please, go on without me."
Shortly after he left, Murata and Kimura excused themselves politely, begging Musashi's forgiveness. The barking grew more urgent. The dog was apparently trying to give warning of some danger. When one of the castle's dogs acted this way, it was almost a sure sign something untoward was going on. The peace the country was enjoying was not so secure that a daimyo could afford to relax his vigilance against neighboring fiefs. There were still unscrupulous warriors who might stoop to anything to satisfy their own ambition, and spies roamed the land searching out complacent and vulnerable targets. Kizaimon seemed extremely upset. He kept staring at the ominous light of the little lamp, as if counting the echoes of the unearthly noise. Eventually, there was one long, mournful wail. Kizaemon grunted and looked at Musashi.
"He's dead," said Musashi. "Yes, he's been killed."
No longer able to contain himself, Kizaemon stood up.
"I can't understand it."
He started to leave, but Musashi stopped him, saying,
"Wait, is Jotaro, the boy who came with me, still in the waiting room?"
They directed their inquiry to a young samurai in front of the Shin-in-do, who after searching, reported the boy was nowhere to be found. A look of concern came over Musashi's face. Turning to Kizaemon, he said,
"I think I know what happened. Would you mind my going with you?"
"Not at all."
About 300 yards from the dojo, a crowd had gathered, and several torches had been lit. Besides Murata, Debuchi, and Kimura, there were a number of foot soldiers and guards forming a black circle, all talking and shouting at once. From the outer rim of the circle, Musashi peered into the open space in the middle. His heart sank. There, just as he had feared, was Jotaro, covered with blood and looking like the devil's own child, wooden sword in hand, his teeth tightly clenched, his shoulders rising and falling with his heavy breathing. By his side lay Taro, teeth bared, legs outstretched. The dog's sightless eyes reflected the light of the torches. Blood trickled from his mouth.
"It's his lordship's dog," someone said mournfully.
A samurai went toward Jotaro and shouted,
"You little bastard! What have you done? Are you the one who killed this dog?"
The man brought his hand down in a furious slap, which Jotaro just managed to dodge. Squaring his shoulders, he shouted defiantly,
"Yes, I did it!"
"You admit it?"
"I had a reason."
"Ha!
I was taking revenge."
"What?"
There was general astonishment at Jotaro's answer. The whole crowd was angry. Taro was the favorite pet of Lord Munenori of Tajima. Not only that, he was the pedigreed offspring of Raiko, a bitch belonging to and much loved by Lord Yorinori of Kishu. Lord Yorinori had personally given the pup to Munenori, who had himself reared it. The slaying of the animal would consequently be investigated thoroughly, and the fate of the two samurai who had been paid to take good care of the dog was now in jeopardy. The man now facing Jotaro was one of these two.
"Shut up!"
he shouted, aiming his fist at Jotaro's head. This time, Jotaro did not duck in time. The blow landed in the vicinity of his ear. Jotaro raised his hand to feel his wound.
"What are you doing?"
he screamed.
"You killed the master's dog! You don't mind if I beat you to death the same way, do you? Because that's exactly what I'm going to do.
All I did was get even with him. Why punish me for that? A grown man should know that's not right."
In Jotaro's view, he had only protected his honor and risked his life in doing so, for a visible wound was a great disgrace to a samurai. To defend his pride, there was no alternative to killing the dog. Indeed, in all likelihood, he had expected to be praised for his valiant conduct. He stood his ground, determined not to flinch.
"Shut your impudent mouth!" screamed the keeper. "I don't care if you are only a child. You're old enough to know the difference between a dog and a human being. The very idea, taking revenge on a dumb animal!"
He grabbed Jotaro's collar, looked to the crowd for approval, and declared it his duty to punish the dog's murderer. The crowd silently nodded in agreement. The four men who had so recently been entertaining Musashi looked distressed but said nothing.
"Bark, boy! Bark like a dog!"
the keeper shouted. He swung Jotaro around and around by his collar, and with a black look in his eye, threw him to the ground. Seizing an oak staff, he raised it above his head, ready to strike.
"You killed the dog, you little hoodlum! Now it's your turn! Stand up, so I can kill you! Bark! Bite me!"
Teeth tightly clenched, Jotaro propped himself up on one arm and struggled to his feet, wooden sword in hand. His features had not lost their sprite-like quality, but the expression on his face was anything but childlike, and the howl that issued from his throat was eerily savage. When an adult gets angry, he often regrets it later, but when a child's wrath is aroused, not even the mother who brought him into the world can placate him.
"Kill me!" he screamed. "Go on, kill me!"
"Die then," raged the keeper. He struck.
The blow would have killed the boy if it had connected, but it didn't. A sharp crack reverberated in the ears of the bystanders, and Jotaro's wooden sword went flying through the air. Without thinking about it, he had parried the keeper's blow. Weaponless, he closed his eyes and charged blindly at the enemy's midriff, latching onto the man's obi with his teeth. Holding on for dear life, he tore with his nails at the keeper's groin, while the keeper made futile swings with his staff. Musashi had remained silent, arms folded and face expressionless, but then another oak staff appeared. A second man had dashed into the ring and was on the verge of attacking Jotaro from behind. Musashi moved into action. His arms came down, and in no time he forced his way through the solid wall of men into the arena.
"Coward!"
he shouted at the second man. An oak stick and two legs described an arc in the air, coming to rest in a clump about 4 yards away. Musashi shouted,
"And now for you, you little devil!"
Gripping Jotaro's obi with both hands, he lifted the boy above his head and held him there. Turning to the keeper, who was taking a fresh grip on his staff, he said,
"I've been watching this from the start, and I think you're going about it the wrong way. This boy is my servant, and if you're going to question him, you ought to question me, too."
In fiery tones, the keeper answered,
"All right, we'll do that. We'll question the two of you. Good. We'll take you on together. Now, here's the boy."
He threw Jotaro straight at the man. The crowd let out an appalled gasp and fell back. Was the man mad? Whoever heard of using one human being as a weapon against another human? The keeper stared in disbelief as Jotaro sailed through the air and rammed into his chest. The man fell straight back as though a prop holding him up had suddenly been removed. It was difficult to tell whether he had struck his head against a rock or whether his ribs had been broken. Hitting the ground with a howl, he began vomiting blood. Jotaro bounced off the man's chest, did a somersault in the air, and rolled like a ball to a point 20 or 30 feet away.
"Did you see that?" a man shouted. "Who is this crazy ronin?"
The fracas no longer involved only the dog's keeper. The other samurai began abusing Musashi. Most of them were unaware that Musashi was an invited guest, and several suggested killing him then and there.
"Now," said Musashi, "everybody listen."
They watched him closely as he took Jotaro's wooden sword in his hand and faced them, a terrifying scowl on his face.
"The child's crime is his master's crime. We are both prepared to pay for it. But first, let me tell you this. We have no intention of letting ourselves be killed like dogs. We are prepared to take you on."
Instead of acknowledging the crime and taking his punishment, he was challenging them. If at this point Musashi had apologized for Jotaro and spoken in his defense, if he had made even the slightest effort to soothe the ruffled feelings of the Yagyu samurai, the whole incident might have passed by quietly. But Musashi's attitude precluded this. He seemed set on creating a still greater disturbance. Shoda, Kimura, Debuchi, and Murata all frowned, wondering anew what sort of freak they had invited to the castle. Deploring his lack of sense, they gradually edged around the crowd while keeping a watchful eye on him. The crowd had been seething to begin with, and Musashi's challenge exasperated their anger.
"Listen to him! He's an outlaw! He's a spy! Tie him up! No, cut him up! Don't let him get away!"
For a moment, it looked as though Musashi and Jotaro, who was again by his side, would be swallowed up by a sea of swords. But then an authoritative voice cried,
"Wait!"
It was Kizaemon, who together with Debuchi and Murata was trying to hold the crowd in check.
"This man seems to have planned all this," said Kizaemon. "If you let him entice you, and you're wounded or killed, we shall have to answer to his lordship for it. The dog was important, but not as important as a human life. The four of us will assume all responsibility. Rest assured, no harm will befall you because of anything we do. Now calm down and go home."
With some reluctance, the others dispersed, leaving the four men who had entertained Musashi in the Shinindo. It was no longer a case of guest and hosts, but one of an outlaw facing his judges.
"Musashi," said Kizaemon, "I'm sorry to tell you your plot has failed. I suppose someone put you up to spying on Koyagyu Castle or just stirring up trouble, but I'm afraid it didn't work."
As they pressed in on Musashi, he was keenly aware that there was not one among them who was not an expert with the sword. He stood quite still, his hand on Jotaro's shoulder. Surrounded, he couldn't have escaped even if he'd had wings.
"Musashi!"
called Debuchi, working his sword a little way out of its scabbard.
"You failed! The proper thing for you to do is commit suicide. You may be a scoundrel, but you showed a great deal of bravery coming into this castle with only that child at your side. We had a friendly evening together. Now we'll wait while you prepare yourself for harakiri. When you're ready, you can prove that you're a real samurai."
That would have been the ideal solution. They had not consulted with Sekishusai, and if Musashi died now, the whole affair could be buried along with his body. Musashi had other ideas.
"You think I should kill myself? That's absurd. I have no intention of dying, not for a long time."
His shoulders shook with laughter.
"All right,"
said Debuchi. The tone was quiet, but the meaning was crystal clear.
"We've tried to treat you decently, but you've done nothing but take advantage of us."
Kimura broke in, saying,
"There's no need for further talk."
He went behind Musashi and pushed him.
"Walk!"
he commanded.
"Walk where?" "To the cells!"
Musashi nodded and started walking, but in the direction of his own choice, straight toward the castle keep.
"Where do you think you're going?"
cried Kimura, jumping in front of Musashi and stretching his arms out to block him.
"This isn't the way to the cells. They're in back of you. Turn around and get going."
"No,"
cried Musashi. He looked down at Jotaro, who was still clinging to his side, and told him to go sit under a pine tree in the garden in front of the keep. The ground around the pine trees was covered with carefully raked white sand. Jotaro darted from under Musashi's sleeve and hid behind the tree, wondering all the while what Musashi intended to do next. The memory of his teacher's bravery at Hanya Plain came back to him, and his body swelled with excitement. Kizaemon and Debuchi took positions on either side of Musashi and tried to pull him back by the arms. Musashi didn't budge.
"Let's go."
"I'm not going."
"You intend to resist?"
"I do."
Kimura lost patience and started to draw his sword, but his seniors, Kizaemon and Debuchi, ordered him to hold off.
"What's the matter with you? Where do you think you're going?"
"I intend to see Yagyu Sekishusai."
"You what?"
Never had it crossed their minds that this insane youth could have even thought of anything so preposterous.
"And what would you do if you met him?"
asked Kizaemon. "I'm a young man. I'm studying the martial arts, and it is one of my goals in life to receive a lesson from the master of the Yagyu style."
"If that's what you wanted, why didn't you just ask?"
"Isn't it true that Sekishusai never sees anyone and never gives lessons to student warriors?"
"Yes."
"Then what else can I do but challenge him? I realize, of course, that even if I do, he'll probably refuse to come out of retirement. So I'm challenging this whole castle to a battle instead.
A battle?
Chorus the four.
His arm still held by Kizaemon and Debuchi, Musashi looked up at the sky. There was a flapping sound as an eagle flew toward them from the blackness enveloping Mount Kasagi. Like a giant shroud, its silhouette hid the stars from view before it glided noisily down to the roof of the rice storehouse. To the four retainers, the word battle sounded so melodramatic as to be laughable, but to Musashi, it barely sufficed to express his concept of what was to come. He was not talking about a fencing match to be decided by technical skill only. He meant total war, where the combatants concentrate every ounce of their spirit and ability, and their fates are decided. A battle between two armies might be different in form, but in essence it was the same. It was simple. A battle between one man and one castle. His willpower was manifest in the firmness with which his heels were now implanted in the ground. It was this iron determination that made the word battle come naturally to his lips. The four men scrutinized his face, wondering again if he had an iota of sanity left. Kimura took up the challenge. Kicking his straw sandals into the air and tucking up his hakama, he said,
"Fine. Nothing I like better than a battle. I can't offer you rolling drums or clanging gongs, but I can offer you a fight. Shoda, Debuchi, push him over here."
Kimura had been the first to suggest that they should punish Musashi, but he had held himself back, trying to be patient. Now he had had his fill.
"Go ahead," he urged. "Leave him to me."
At exactly the same time, Kizaemon and Debuchi shoved Musashi forward. He stumbled four or five paces toward Kimura. Kimura stepped back a pace, lifted his elbow above his face, and sucking in his breath, swiftly brought his sword down toward Musashi's stumbling form. There was a curious, gritty sound as the sword flashed through the air. At the same time, a shout was heard, not from Musashi, but from Jotaro, who had jumped out from his position behind the pine tree. The handful of sand he had thrown was the source of the strange noise. Realizing that Kimura would be gauging the distance so as to strike effectively, Musashi had deliberately added speed to his stumbling steps, and at the time of the strike was much closer to Kimura than the latter had anticipated. His sword touched nothing but air and sand. Both men quickly jumped back, separating themselves by three or four paces. There they stood, staring menacingly at one another in the tension-filled stillness.
"This is going to be something to watch," said Kizaemon softly.
Debuchi and Murata, though not within the sphere of battle, both took up new positions and assumed defensive stances. From what they had seen so far, they had no illusions about Musashi's competence as a fighter. His evasion and recovery had already convinced them he was a match for Kimura. Kimura's sword was positioned slightly lower than his chest. He stood motionless. Musashi, equally still, had his hand on the hilt of his sword, right shoulder forward and elbow high. His eyes were two white, polished stones in his shadowy face. For a time, it was a battle of nerves. But before either man moved, the darkness around Kimura seemed to waver, to change indefinably. Soon it was obvious that he was breathing faster and with greater agitation than Musashi. A low grunt, barely audible, issued from Debuchi. He knew now that what had started as a comparatively trivial matter was about to turn into a catastrophe. Kizaemon and Murata, he felt sure, understood this as well as he. It was not going to be easy to put an end to this.
The outcome of the fight between Musashi and Kimura was as good as decided, unless extraordinary steps were taken. Reluctant as the three other men were to do anything that suggested cowardice, they found themselves forced to act to prevent disaster. The best solution would be to rid themselves of the strange, unbalanced intruder as expeditiously as possible, without themselves suffering needless wounds. No exchange of words was needed. They communicated perfectly with their eyes. Acting in unison, the three moved in on Musashi. At the same instant, Musashi's sword, with the twang of a bowstring, pierced the air, and a thunderous shout filled the empty space. The battle cry came not from his mouth alone, but from his whole body, the sudden peal of a temple bell resounding in all directions. From his opponents, arrayed to both sides of him, to front and back, came a hissing gurgle. Musashi felt vibrantly alive. His blood seemed about to burst from every pore, but his head was as cool as ice. Was this the flaming lotus of which the Buddhists spoke? The ultimate heat made one with the ultimate cold, the synthesis of flame and water. No more sand sailed through the air. Jotaro had disappeared. Gusts of wind whistled down from the peak of Mount Kasagi. Tightly held swords glinted luminescently. One against four. Yet Musashi felt himself at no great disadvantage. He was conscious of a swelling in his veins. At times like this, the idea of dying is said to assert itself in the mind, but Musashi had no thought of death. At the same time, he felt no certainty of his ability to win. The wind seemed to blow through his head, cooling his brain, clearing his vision. Though his body was growing sticky and beads of oily sweat glistened on his forehead. There was a faint rustle. Like a beetle's antennae, Musashi's sword told him that the man on his left had moved his foot an inch or two. He made the necessary adjustment in the position of his weapon, and the enemy, also perceptive, made no further move to attack. The five formed a seemingly static tableau. Musashi was aware that the longer this continued, the less advantageous it was for him. He would have liked somehow to have his opponents not around him, but stretched out in a straight line, to take them on one by one, but he was not dealing with amateurs. The fact was that until one of them shifted of his own accord, Musashi could make no move. All he could do was wait and hope that eventually one would make a momentary misstep and give him an opening. His adversaries took little comfort from their superiority in numbers. They knew that at the slightest sign of a relaxed attitude on the part of any one of them, Musashi would strike. Here, they understood, was the type of man that one did not ordinarily encounter in this world. Even Kizaemon could make no move.
"What a strange man," he thought to himself.
Swords, men, earth, sky. Everything seemed to have frozen solid. But then into this stillness came a totally unexpected sound, the sound of a flute wafted by the wind. As the melody stole into Musashi's ears, he forgot himself, forgot the enemy, forgot about life and death. Deep in the recess of his mind, he knew this sound, for it was the one that had enticed him out of hiding on Mount Takateru, the sound that had delivered him into the hands of Takuan. It was Otsu's flute, and it was Otsu playing it. He went limp inside. Externally, the change was barely perceptible, but that was enough. With a battle cry rising from his loins, Kimura lunged forward, his sword arm seeming to stretch out 6 or 7 feet. Musashi's muscles tensed, and the blood seemed to rush through him toward a state of hemorrhage. He was sure he had been cut. His left sleeve was rent from shoulder to wrist, and the sudden exposure of his arm made him think the flesh had been cut open. For once, his self-possession left him, and he screamed out the name of the god of war. He leaped, turned suddenly, and saw Kimura stumble toward the place where he himself had been standing.
"Musashi!"
shouted Debuchi Magobe.
"You talk better than you fight,"
taunted Murata as he and Kizaemon scrambled to head Musashi off. But Musashi gave the earth a powerful kick and sprang high enough to brush against the lower branches of the pine trees. Then he leaped again and again, and off he flew into the darkness, never looking back.
"Coward! Musashi! Fight like a man!"
When Musashi reached the edge of the moat around the inner castle, there was a cracking of twigs, and then silence. The only sound was the sweet melody of the flute in the distance. The Nightingales. There was no way of knowing how much stagnant rainwater might be at the bottom of the 30-foot moat. After diving into the hedge near the top and rapidly sliding halfway down, Musashi stopped and threw a rock. Hearing no splash, he leapt to the bottom, where he lay down on his back in the grass, not making a sound. After a time, his ribs stopped heaving and his pulse returned to normal. As the sweat cooled, he began to breathe regularly again.
"Otsu couldn't be here at Koyagyu," he told himself. "My ears must be playing tricks on me. Still, it's not impossible. It could have been her."
As he debated with himself, he envisioned Otsu's eyes among the stars above him, and soon he was carried away by memories. Otsu at the pass on the Mimasaka-Harima border, where she had said she could not live without him, there was no other man in the world for her. Then, at Hanada Bridge in Himeji, when she had told him how she had waited for him for nearly 1,000 days and would have waited 10 years or 20 until she was old and gray. Her begging him to take her with him, her assertion that she could bear any hardship. His headlong flight at Himeji had been a betrayal. How she must have hated him after that. How she must have bit her lips and cursed the unpredictability of men.
"Forgive me."
The words he had carved on the railing of the bridge slipped from his lips. Tears seeped from the corners of his eyes. He was startled by a cry from the top of the moat. It sounded like, "He's not here!" 3 or 4 pine torches flickered among the trees, then disappeared. They hadn't spotted him. He was annoyed to find himself weeping.
"What do I need with a woman?"
he said scornfully, wiping his eyes with his hands. He jumped to his feet and looked up at the black outline of Koyagyu Castle.
"They called me a coward, said I couldn't fight like a man. Well, I haven't surrendered yet, not by a long shot. I didn't run away, I just made a tactical retreat."
Almost an hour had passed. He began walking slowly along the bottom of the moat. No point in fighting those 4 anyway. That wasn't my aim to begin with. When I find Sekishusai himself, then the real battle will start. He stopped and began gathering fallen branches, which he broke into short sticks over his knee. Shoving them one by one into cracks in the stone wall, he used them for footholds and climbed out of the moat. He could no longer hear the flute. For a second, he had the vague feeling Jotaro was calling, but when he stopped and listened closely, he could hear nothing. He wasn't really worried about the boy. He could take care of himself. He was probably miles away by now. The absence of torches indicated the search had been called off, at least for the night. The thought of finding and defeating Sekishusai was once again his controlling passion, the immediate shape taken by his overpowering desire for recognition and honor.
He had heard from the innkeeper that Sekishusai's retreat was in neither of the castle encirclements, but in a secluded spot in the outer grounds. He walked through the woods and valleys, at times suspecting he had strayed outside the castle grounds. Then a bit of moat, a stone wall or a rice granary would reassure him he was still inside. All night he searched, compelled by a diabolic urge. He intended, once he had found the mountain house, to burst in with his challenge on his lips. But as the hours wore on, he would have welcomed the sight of even a ghost appearing in Sekishusai's form. It was getting on toward daybreak when he found himself at the back gate of the castle. Beyond it rose a precipice, and above that, Mount Kasagi. On the verge of screaming with frustration, he retraced his steps southward. Finally, at the bottom of a slope inclined toward the southeast quarter of the castle, well-shaped trees and well-trimmed grass told him he'd found the hideaway. His conjecture was soon confirmed by a gate with a thatched roof, in the style favored by the great tea master Sen no Rikyu. Inside, he could make out a bamboo grove shrouded in morning mist. Peeking through a crack in the gate, he saw that the path meandered through the grove and up the hill, as in Zen Buddhist mountain retreats. For a moment, he was tempted to leap over the fence, but he checked himself. Something about the surroundings held him back. Was it the loving care that had been lavished on the area, or the sight of white petals on the ground? Whatever it was, the sensitivity of the occupant came through, and Musashi's agitation subsided. He suddenly thought of his appearance. He must look like a tramp, with his disheveled hair and his kimono in disarray. No need to rush, he said to himself, conscious now of his exhaustion. He had to pull himself together before presenting himself to the master inside. Sooner or later, he thought, someone's bound to come to the gate. That'll be time enough. If he still refuses to see me as a wandering student, then I'll use a different approach. He sat down under the eaves of the gate, leaned his back against the post, and dropped off to sleep. The stars were fading and white daisies swaying in the breeze when a large drop of dew fell coldly on his neck and woke him up. Daylight had come, and as he stirred from his nap, his head was cleansed by the morning breeze and the singing of the nightingales. No vestige of weariness remained. He felt reborn. Rubbing his eyes and looking up, he saw the bright red sun climbing over the mountains. He jumped up. The sun's heat had already rekindled his ardor, and the strength stored up in his limbs demanded action. Stretching, he said softly, "Today's the day." He was hungry, and for some reason, this made him think about Jotaro. Perhaps he had treated the boy too roughly the night before, but it had been a calculated move, a part of the lad's training. Musashi again assured himself that Jotaro, wherever he wasn't in any real danger. He listened to the sound of the brook, which ran down the mountainside, detoured inside the fence, circled the bamboo grove, and then emerged from under the fence on its journey toward the lower castle grounds. Musashi washed his face and drank his fill in lieu of breakfast. The water was good, so good that Musashi imagined it might well be the main reason Sekishusai had chosen this location for his retirement from the world. Still, knowing nothing of the art of the tea ceremony, he had no inkling that water of such purity was in fact the answer to a tea master's prayer. He rinsed his hand and towel in the stream, and having wiped the back of his neck thoroughly, cleaned the grime from his nails. He then tidied his hair with the stiletto attached to his sword. Since Sekishusai was not only the master of the Yagyu style, but one of the greatest men in the land, Musashi intended to look his best. He himself was nothing but a nameless warrior, as different from Sekishusai as the tiniest star is from the moon.
patting his hair and straightening his collar, he felt inwardly composed. His mind was clear. He was resolved to knock at the gate like any legitimate caller.
The house was quite a way up the hill, and it wasn't likely an ordinary